allies think they get him this time. So how do traditional partners of the United States deal with the second coming of Donald Trump? Should they worry? The long list of far-right liberals invited to next Monday's inauguration in Washington points to a president-elect bent, some say, on revenge against those who wrote him off. Critics contended, for instance, that he would give Benjamin Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin whatever they wanted. It rattled the Washington consensus. Already, that's proven partially wrong, what with Trump and his Mideast envoy putting pressure on Israel to sign a Gaza ceasefire. We'll ask why and whether the new occupant of the White House will force Ukraine into a rush deal that gifts Russia enlarged borders, or whether the U.S. will ditch defense for Europe. We'll weigh arguments that point in opposite directions there. More broadly, how do traditional NATO allies engage with the author of The Art of the Deal? And what does America First mean this time around for Europe, where Trump's got, well, a growing legion of far-right fans? Today in the France 24 debate, four more years. Joining us from New York City, Yascha Mounk, professor at Johns Hopkins University and the host of the Good Fight podcast. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
With us as well, Anastasia Shapochkina, president of the Eastern Circles think tank, lecturer in geopolitics at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Resolutions for 2025?
Absolutely.
All right. You're keeping those under wraps, though. With us as well, Gesine Weber, research fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States think tank. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Craig Capitis, European correspondent for Newsmax. Good to see you.
Hi, Francois.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Yeah, the ink was not yet dry in Doha on Wednesday, and already Donald Trump was crowing on his social medium, Truth Social, saying, quote, this epic ceasefire agreement could only have happened as a result of our historic victory back in November. Soon after, Israel's prime minister posting a picture immortalizing the meeting of minds between himself and the Donald after that Gaza ceasefire deal. Of course, that's not how it's being reported in other circles. The idea being that Trump sent his envoy to Jerusalem last weekend to read Netanyahu the Riot Act. And that surprised some Israelis. Yascha Mounk, did we misread Donald Trump?
Well, it's very early days, and you know, I think it's a little bit hard to understand to what extent this deal is a result of efforts by the Biden administration, to what extent it has to do with the fact that Donald Trump has put some amount of pressure on both sides. It has been interesting to observe more broadly, you know, a little bit of what we might call the madman effect. You know, this is an old theory in international relations, and I think Donald Trump himself has sort of alluded to the fact that he seems to believe in it, where if you are predictable, that makes it very easy for your adversaries to respond. If you're unpredictable, then they must fear that you're going to do something extreme, and it can often lead to better negotiation results. Of course, the downside of a madman theory is that while that can, in fact, help you get your way in many situations, it could also lead to escalation, conflict, or outright war.
The madman theory applies, as you say, to adversaries. In the case of Benjamin Netanyahu, the reputation was Trump was going to come in and give Netanyahu everything he wants. He's a darling of the Republican Party.
That's true. I mean, I think there's a real question about who the sticking party for the peace deal was. There's, you know, rival conflicting accounts of this. You know, senior figures in the Biden administration have recently said that the reason why the peace deal hasn't happened so far was more Hamas than Israel. So one theory of this is that Netanyahu wants to please the incoming Trump administration, that he wants to keep Trump on his good side, that he wants to give his win to Trump in order to maintain the relationship. But perhaps he is worried, along with the madman theory, that while Trump is his best friend, he's also pretty ruthless in pursuing his own interests, and he might suddenly sour on the relationship. Another theory is that Hamas was more willing to strike this deal at this point because they understood that Trump would give Israel, even more so than the Biden administration, a completely free hand in what to do unless they struck the deal.
All right, so facts on the ground have changed since Donald Trump left office in 2021. Speaking of talking on the telephone, Trump's new national security advisor saying the president-elect will speak with his Russian counterpart in the coming days or weeks. Anastasia Shapochkina, that has Ukrainians like yourself alarmed, perhaps, but at the same time, he's appointed as his pivot person for Ukraine, someone who's rather hawkish when it comes to Russia.
Definitely, and who has given him advice about Putin, which is very much in line of what Ukrainians have been saying all along. And so far in Kyiv, first of all, I don't think there was a real expectation and a real even anticipation that Kamala Harris was going to win the elections. When we went throughout 2024 to Kyiv and talked to people there, from political elites to businesses to the experts, everybody was pretty much readying for Donald Trump to win. That was the perception. That was also the discourse. And the discourse has remained across all the layers of society who's going to deal with this, is that Trump is, we're going to have to deal with this. We're going to have to find a way to deal with this.
And yeah, so even the military strategy, like taking that part of Kursk region inside Russia, was part of a bargaining process they'd be brought to sooner than later?
Definitely, Kursk is part of the bargaining process and preparation for the negotiations. I don't think it depended on Trump or not Trump. I think it's really something that's done by Ukrainians in order to prepare for facing Putin. But also, it does send a message to Trump, because if one thing the Ukrainians want to send a message about is that they are not a weak party which can accomplish nothing, that even with very limited resources, they still can reach results. Whether that's the message that Trump is receiving, that's a different story, but that's something that they definitely want to send. There is not a despair when it comes to Trump from the Ukrainian side, and very far from it. And really, I think there has been a lot of preparation for the Trump presidency more than for any other outcome, really.
All right, so proceeding as if they were ready and prepared for what happens after Monday, sort of similar for NATO allies continuing to make the pilgrimage by train to Kyiv. Latest example overnight, Britain's Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who's often been in the crosshairs of Donald Trump. He signed deals, and including what he called a 100-year partnership with Ukraine, and continuing to pledge support.
We're signing a 100-year partnership between UK and Ukraine. This is a real statement of our intent for the long term in relation to our commitment to Ukraine. One of the consequences of this conflict has been to draw NATO more strongly together. It's bigger and stronger than it has been, and we must stand behind Ukraine for as long as it takes.
As long as it takes. Gesine Weber, when you watch that, do you feel as though you're watching the final days of NATO's support for Ukraine as it is? Or do you take Keir Starmer at his word?
I think that Europeans have made very clear from the beginning that as long as it takes in terms of support for Ukraine is really something they have been living up to. And I think since the very beginning, the European partners have been question to what extent they are really going to also implement that. And I think when we look about the continuous support from Europeans, on the one hand from individual European states, but also from the European Union to Ukraine, we really see that Europeans continue to deliver. Yes, they could have delivered more in the past, and I'm especially thinking about big member states, like, for example, Germany. But I think that particularly the UK, to come back to a snippet we just saw from Starmer, has proven exceptional leadership among the Europeans, because it has not only led the response in terms of military support, but also continuously pushes the other Europeans. And that's why I think this visit is important.
But the biggest military contributor by far since February of 2022 has been the United States. What happens after next Monday?
The thing is that we don't know, and I think probably the United States also do not know. So for Europeans, this massive black box in terms of Ukraine policy coming out of Washington is a significant challenge. But I think that everyone in Europe is clear that the current level of support will not, or the current level of transatlantic support, as we've seen it until now, will probably not continue. And that is also why, on the one hand, Europeans are looking into how they can potentially fill the gaps from that will be left if the United States do not continue their military support beyond the last supplemental that we have seen, but also why we also see the reflections on potential negotiations, because there is also a risk that the United States will push for precisely that.
Be it with the Middle East, Craig Capitis, or with Ukraine, there's a bit of a guessing game going on as to what are Donald Trump's motivations. Some give him personal motivations. Others say it's transactional with the likes of Saudi Arabia when it comes to the Middle East. When it comes to Ukraine, what are the motivations?
Well, I think the starting point is you have to understand that Trump inhabits a completely different mental world, and he does so naturally and gracefully. And he won the election, and he controls the media. That's your starting point. Yes, he is transactional. On Ukraine, I believe, or at least claim to believe, that President Macron is going to be playing a very large part in whatever happens in Ukraine. Trump and Macron get along extremely well. Macron is a friend of Ukraine. And as far as the money, and Anastasia can rap me on the knuckles if I'm wrong, the bulk of that money for Ukraine actually stays in the United States because it's making weapons that go to Ukraine. And Trump needs to get the economy re-ramped up. So he's certainly not going to lose that generated income. I don't think that's going to be a bargaining chip on any table, but I guarantee you it's going to be on his mind. And remember something about Trump in all of these negotiations. Trump is a television star. He's used to playing a character, playing a businessman. He understands fiction. He sells fiction. His world is one of fiction. He loves pomp and circumstance. So I think this is where, and I, in fact, I'll underscore it. I think Macron is going to have a huge role to play in the fate of Ukraine. And the joker in the deck, and if I'm jumping ahead, I apologize, is going to be the people he nominates as his security advisors and Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State.
All right, 2 points in there. Let's pick up on the first one. Emmanuel Macron, you say because he's the one with whom he's got a conduit.
Oh, yes, they are. They're the I hate the word, but it's true. There's a bromance there. They actually like each other, and they get on. I wrote a column on this a few weeks ago by someone who's in the room. Macron doesn't really make fun of Trump. Okay, he listens to Trump.
Yeah, but he said that, for instance, make the planet great again. You know, that was a dig at Trump. You know, he pokes fun at him too.
Well, what you and I may think are digs at Trump, I don't believe Trump actually believes are digs at Trump. I know the two of them get on extremely well, and I know the two of them listen to each other, and I know their mutual bottom line is that the global axis, the world, is changing. It's not what it used to be. The old rules don't work anymore, whether the Guardian would like to make them work or not, or the liberals, or even the conservatives. It's changing. And this is what Macron and Trump share, this understanding that the world is changing, and they each want to try and reshape it in their own manner. And they're going to work together for as long as that's possible.
Before I go to Yasha Monk, Anastasia Shapochkina, are you reassured by what Craig Capitis is saying?
I think another thing that they share, which is maybe even more important, that understanding, which Macron certainly has, is the interest in the Indo-Pacific, France being one of the very few European countries, if not the only European country, which actually controls a few military bases in the region, where the US, which probably is the only region where the US really counts on the European support in the very immediate foreseeable future. And of course, it is incomparable to the Chinese naval presence, to the American naval presence, but the fact that they are there, this is number one. Number two, France is one of the three countries, together with the US and Israel, who are very well positioned in India, which is notoriously a geopolitical rival of China, which is going to become more and more important geopolitically for the US. And France, unlike the US, has a goodwill kind of in store with India and good relations with Modi. If you think that Macron and Trump have bromance, you should have seen the pictures of Macron and Modi hugging last time Modi visited. Francois remembers those. He covered them.
I remember those. Yasha Monk, you agree?
More or less. Look, I think there's fears that Trump is going to give Ukraine as a gift-wrapped present to Vladimir Putin because of the extent to which Trump supposedly sympathizes with Putin. I think that's naive. Trump is a very transactional person who believes that any negotiation, any deal has a clear winner and a clear loser. And no matter whether he might personally like Vladimir Putin or not, his lifelong mission has been to be a winner in every interaction he has in life, which means that the other side has to lose. I do think there's two concerns that Ukraine should have and that I have for Ukraine. The first of these is that Trump could accept as the winning part of the exchange all kinds of things, some which might include Ukrainian security guarantees or the maintenance of at least significant Ukrainian territory that is in dispute. But other things may have nothing to do with Ukraine. And if Trump feels that he gets something out of Putin that is worthwhile to him or to the United States, and he needs to sell Ukraine down the river to do that, I think that he would be willing to go along with that. The second is that Trump has presented what in itself is a perfectly coherent strategy, which is to say to Putin, I want a deal. I want to come to an agreement. And by the way, if you don't come to a deal with me, if you don't accept the agreement, then there's going to be hell to pay. Then we're going to really support Ukraine and it's going to look bad for you. And Trump knows how to talk that up in his hyperbolic language. The question is whether he is willing to call the bluff. Whether if Putin says, well, actually, sorry, none of these terms are acceptable to me, I'm happy to grind it out for another year, Trump will really go to Congress and tell reluctant Republican congressmen and senators to go and support a lot more U.S. spending on Ukrainian military defense. And given how reluctant he has been to do any of that in the past, I'm a little bit concerned that Putin will be willing to see how these things play out, to slow walk the negotiations, to not accept whatever deal is on the table, and to count on the fact that the Ukrainian military will slowly be bled dry because Trump is not willing to put his support behind the country in such a scenario.
Craig Kapitas, you're a former Moscow correspondent. Do you see Vladimir Putin testing, calling Donald Trump's bluff?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, that's what the Russians do. You could ask Ivan the Terrible. He did the same thing.
Anastasia Shapochkina, what then does Donald Trump do?
I think that one thing that Donald Trump maybe is imagining and now maybe he's underestimating is, of course, first of all, the importance. And that's really something that is that everybody understands, I think, in Ukraine and in Europe, is the importance of Ukraine for Russia versus the non-importance of Ukraine for the U.S. traditionally, historically, for as a priority of foreign policy. He also underestimates the incompetence of his upcoming administration about Russia versus the competence of Russians about his upcoming administration, and of course, especially the full ownership of the mind, for example, of very influential people around Donald Trump, such as Elon Musk. Full ownership. Elon Musk is just a rupert of Russian propaganda today, nothing more. And the Russians come prepared to the negotiations. They don't come maybe they come overconfident and arrogant, but they also come prepared. I am not sure that today, within the people who can represent America, within the newly upcoming administration, be it in the Pentagon, be it in the Department of State or elsewhere, so far what we've seen, there are people who are going to match the level of competence, unfortunately. I think those are the worst news, and that's going to be the big contrast with the Biden administration.
The Ukraine envoy that Trump has named is Keith Kellogg. How seriously Trump takes foreign policy and defense can also be measured by some of his other nominees. Take Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth up for his first confirmation hearing before the Senate this week.
Can you name the importance of at least one of the nations in the ASEAN, and what type of agreement we have with at least one of those nations? And how many nations are in ASEAN, by the way?
I couldn't tell you the exact amount of nations in that, but I know we have allies in South Korea and Japan and in AUKUS with Australia, trying to work on submarines with them.
Mr. Hegseth, none of those countries are in ASEAN.
Across.
None of those three countries that you've mentioned are in ASEAN. I suggest you do a little homework before you prepare for these types of negotiations. Listen.
Kazeen Weber, what do you think of the nominee for U.S. Defense Secretary?
Well, I think in the end, we will have to see how he is actually performing, because we always also have to keep in mind that in general, there is it's not only the defense secretary who makes the policy, and there are also teams coming in. But to be honest, I can't tell you.
I mean,
I can.
The Pentagon.
Please, then go ahead.
I mean, we're talking about the Pentagon, which has a larger budget than a lot of EU members.
Larger than France 24's.
Even.
Look, what we saw in these hearings points to two things. First, the how ignorance is ecumenical in Washington, not only from this clown Hegseth, but from these clown senators. There are serious questions of defense. The head of NATO just said that the West should be thinking about preparing for the next war. There were no questions asked about in these hearings about China ramping up its military might and its naval capacities. The ability China's now working to have a first strike capability. America has problems with the ability to sustain war on multiple fronts. None of these key questions were asked by the senator, but we know that Pete Hegseth loves Jesus, and someone should have reminded him that the only thing the Crusaders brought back from their wars was the apricot. But we don't go there. This is where you have the problem, and it's a big problem, and this is where Anastasia put her finger on it. There's a disconnect between domestic policy, which is based in culture war in the United States, thank you, Mr. Hegseth, and foreign policy, which is based on real blood and guts, and we're going to blow the hell out of you, war. They've never come together in the United States.
Not since 1814.
That's exactly correct. And that's the problem that you have here. Is that are these people, is Hegseth, as you pointed out, is he going to survive? The other, who's the first one who's going to go? I think it's going to be Marco Rubio. Because Rubio, you know, even though he's a right-wing
senator. This is the nominee for Secretary of State.
He's a right-wing senator from Florida. But let me tell you something. He understands foreign policy. He knows what's going on in Russia. He knows what's going on in Ukraine. He knows what's going on in Venezuela and China. But is the president going to listen to him? Because there's how transactional can doing those things be for Trump? You know, we don't know. But that's the problem, or two problems. The shared ecumenical stupidity in Washington and the fact that Trump consistently conflates culture war, domestic policy, with foreign policy, which is real war and is gauged in throw weights and all the stuff that you folks at Eastern Circles write about every day. That's what's missing. It's real. This is not a fiction.
Yasha Monk, is it looking as, well, shall we say, precarious as the picture painted there by Craig?
Yes, I think so. I think there was an entertaining and eloquent explanation of some of the contradictions at the heart of a Trump administration. I mean, Marco Rubio doesn't just know foreign policy. He is a relatively traditional Republican nominee. You could have imagined him being foreign secretary under a president, Mitt Romney or somebody like that, even though they have their political disagreements. A lot of the incoming team, not just Hegseth, but people like Tulsi Gabbard, have very, very different views about foreign policy. So perhaps this is going to be a team of rivals, of people who have fundamental disagreements about foreign policy. And somehow over the course of 4 years, that is a productive tension at the heart of the American government. That doesn't seem to me particularly likely. I think that one of the wings of thinking about foreign policy is going to prevail. And the others are either going to subordinate themselves or leave a post. I think Craig knows the sort of Trump wing of American politics probably better than I do. And if he suspects that it's going to be Marco Rubio who's the first to go, I think we should take that seriously. And that to me is concerning because of all of the different appointments that Trump made. I found Marco Rubio, with whom I have my political differences, to be the most reassuring.
And I think that exactly that's the question is who is he going to listen to? And so far, when we look at this, particularly at the war in Ukraine, we look at Russia and Ukraine, we look who are the people who Trump allowed to be present at his phone calls with Zelensky? Who are the people who he's talking to most on these issues? Is it former General Kellogg? No, unfortunately, we've seen Elon Musk being present on those calls. And Elon Musk's understanding of geopolitics is really limited to Twitter feeds. He really doesn't understand anything about either Russia.
But this is the important thing, Stash. He controls the media, and Trump needs to control the media,
controls
the message.
The media?
Well, yes, he does. Donald Trump won the election. He won the popular vote. You know, it's time to stop clutching pearls about this and doing all this deep analysis. One of the reasons he won was because Elon Musk helped sell this through Twitter and as well as other media tech bros, as they're called. This is the reality. Now, you got two ways to go here. You can rail against him, which I don't think is the way to do it. But the other way is to ask questions. And I think you put it. Elon Musk, in our world, from what you and I and all of us here, the Marshall Fund, what you have studied, our backgrounds, Elon Musk doesn't have any business sitting in a room with Zelensky to discuss anything about a peace treaty with Russia. Nothing whatsoever. Full stop. But if he wants to go in and he gets the media attention because of it, will President Trump allow him in that room? That's the question. That's the only question as I see it. Marco Rubio, absolutely in that room. He understands this stuff. We might disagree with some of his policies, but the guy's smart. He understands it. Pete Hegseth? No.
All right. This question of how much these tech bros, as Craig calls them, hold sway, coming up this week at the French Parliament. In his general policy speech, France's brand new center-right prime minister, François Bayrou, lashing out at the illiberal winds that are now blowing from across the Atlantic.
In the defense of the international rule of law, we had a great ally, the United States. However, the United States has chosen to pursue the same policy of power and domination by other means, fortunately not by violence. This new world order, or rather this new world disorder, threatens all balances and all rules of decency. There are a certain number of figures that embody it without fear, such as Mr. Elon Musk.
Gesine Weber, there's the veracity of what he's saying. Maybe you agree or not with what he says. And was that the right way to say it?
Whether that's the right way to say it is not up to me to judge. But I think that there is definitely an element that is very concerning for European publics. And that is the way how Elon Musk engages, if you put it diplomatically, in European, in domestic politics. We have seen it, for example, also last week when he had an interview with the German far-right leader, Alice Weidel, on X. And in general, it is not necessarily the way people in foreign governments used to interact with other states diplomatically, including through giving really explicit recommendations on upcoming elections. So I think
does it give the far-right AfD a boost ahead of next month's snap elections in Germany?
Well, it's very hard to measure to what extent an interview with Elon Musk on X will in the end really influence the vote. But I think it is very clear to say that it enhances the visibility. And that it might either generate sympathy or lead to the opposite, dependent on what your take on Elon Musk is.
Yascha Mounk, we've talked about Elon Musk quite a bit. He does grab attention. Is this, again, part of the sort of the tabloidy kind of spectacle that Donald Trump likes, as described by Craig earlier in the conversation, and this will eventually pass? Or are we headed to a world where the United States, for strategic interests, reasons, meddles in European politics?
Well, I think on this, I would distinguish between, the Trump administration, that in the past has also flirted in various ways with far-right political movements. And for all of his friendship with Emmanuel Macron, Craig, I think Donald Trump would probably be quite pleased if Marine Le Pen were to be the next president of France. And he's certainly, his ambassador to Germany seemed to engage in certain forms of outreach to the AfD when he was in Berlin between 2016 and 2020. So there's nothing completely new here. But Elon Musk is a solo agent. He is, teamed up with Donald Trump. He has been given an interesting and challenging task as the co-head of the Department of Government Efficiency of DOGE. But he is speaking as, a private entrepreneur and owner of a social media platform when he interviews Alice Weidel, I think. To me, the broader question is about free speech and social media. And when I hear the debate between the European critics of Silicon Valley and Twitter and after his recent announcements, Mark Zuckerberg on the one side, and the sort of superfans of Musk in particular, I have to say I always wish for both of them to lose, because I think that neither of them is able to think about the situation in a principled way. We have had very significant censorship of social media platforms for the last 5 or 10 years, and it has made us incapable of discussing questions that have turned out to be important, such as, for example, the origin of a COVID pandemic, which you could not really discuss on the most important social media platforms for years because it was wrongly announced and decided that the possibility that there may have been an inadvertent lab leak was some kind of terrible conspiracy theory. And when I see much of the European Union and many leaders in Brussels say as a matter of pride that their role in the world should be as the world's chief regulator, that includes the ability of various political powers to tell us what we can and can't say on platforms like Twitter or Facebook, I have to say that I consider that a considerable danger to democracy itself. Now, on the other side, we have people like Elon Musk who promised to restore free speech to social media, who did that for certain topics on X in a way that I think has truly been solitary. We have people like Mark Zuckerberg realizing that much of the enterprise of fact-checking that Facebook was running ended up being politically partisan, and that crowdsourced mechanisms like Wikipedia uses for its article or like Community Notes uses for Twitter are actually superior to that. But we also have people like Elon Musk just acting very irresponsibly in a personal manner. Using his platform not just to allow different kind of voices to have a say, but to very clearly boost some deeply irresponsible accounts that persistently post falsehoods or spread political views that are very extreme. And we've seen that in some cases, Elon Musk himself has been willing to censor things that he found to be upsetting or that challenged him in various kinds of ways. So I wish that either in Europe or in America, there were more consistent defenders of a very important value of free speech in this debate.
Let me ask you, Gesine Weber, next Monday at the inauguration, you're going to have Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, who will all be there. Is this the end of the European Union as the great regulator, as Yasha was alluding to how some in Brussels see their own role?
I wouldn't say so. And I have to say, I think that it's really good that the European Union is taking up that role and is also really looking very critically at the movements that we are seeing at the moment from the United States, because I think it's important to remember that part of democracy and freedom of speech is also that it basically ends when it puts other people in danger and when it openly questions the individual rights of people. And when I see that after the modifications to, for example, the content management or the content checking and management on Facebook, for example, it's now possible to call women objects and to really have very insulting and also, I think, threatening content for women, people of color, or minorities, then I have to say I'm happy that I live in a European Union where we take individual rights very seriously.
Craig Capitis.
I think there's two things you have to keep in mind here. Whatever the European Union might do to try and rein these people in, they don't have enough money to do the fight in court. The European Union does not have the lawyers, it does not have the bankroll to go up against these people long term. We've seen this over and over again in other areas. I have no idea how we rein in or muzzle or whatever you want, whatever verb you want to use, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and these so-called tech bros.
Well, you have countries like Brazil that have managed to make Musk buckle when it came to their regulations.
Yeah, but
Google
he's still sneaking through the cracks.
Russia.
Yeah, well, you shut it down 100%. I don't think the EU is going to shut down, block Facebook and Twitter and everyone else who they want to block from coming
in. They made
in.
Google pay billions in fines.
And yeah, and they paid survived. It. And they paid it. But look how long it took. The whole game plan here, if you're sitting, you know, I used to cover this stuff at the Journal. The whole game plan of this, when you're sued or taken to court by a government, is to stretch it out for as long as possible because the company has the resources. The government really doesn't. And this is precisely what Trump did with all of his cases in the United States. So that's one thing. The question is that, you know, this misogyny and all this other stuff that you're seeing floating across on Facebook and Twitter and all this, how do you stop it? I don't think you stop it with regulation. I don't see how that is going to work.
This is just one way of dealing with business, is going through courts and then pouring money over it. But there is another example. Let's take an example of the Czech Republic. Once Russia invaded Ukraine, the Czech Republic faced a little problem. One of its big companies, which also is involved in civil nuclear energy, was absolutely tied hand and fist with Rosatom. And it was
Rosatom, which is the Russian government corporation.
Yeah. Yes, it's a state corporation, and it's a nuclear civil is responsible for many, many different areas of nuclear, not just civil and military, both. And what was one way to go would be to go down the legal way and to go and start untangling this very big, you know, kind of knot involving hundreds of companies, and would have taken obviously eternity and bazillions. However, the Czech government pursued a very simple strategy. It just ruled by decree. And with a simple stroke of pen, it said, all of these companies, they no longer, whatever belongs
so
to France Rosatom,
no longer belongs to France is going to rule by decree that Twitter can no longer exist in France. Facebook can no longer exist in France. I'm willing to bet the Sky Ranch that
that's not what I am saying. That's not what I'm saying. What they can do, the governments, they can enforce. They can enforce absolutely their point and their laws as absolutely as you're saying. And this is possible. How they're going to do it? They're going to choose, and each situation demands. And I think that that your correspondent in New York is
Yasha Monk
raising a hand.
have disagreements, but let's not slide into Orwellian language. I mean, to say, as Gesine did, that, not only is it somehow democratically justified for governments to tell their own citizens what they can and can't say, but in fact, it is freedom of speech for us to decide that others can't say what they want, really is making, not just a hash of political language, but not allowing us to see reality for what it is. I think that all of these ideas that the European Union can be this great regulator in chief are just a pure delusion. The European Union thinks it can regulate AI and be a leader in that new technology in that way. Well, it's easy to regulate AI in a very strict way if you have no companies advocating and lobbying for less strict regulations, because you don't have an AI company worth speaking of in the entire European Union. And it is, I think, similarly delusional to think that even with a stroke of a pen banning Twitter or Facebook or doing anything else is going to stop European publics from using the widely available technology of social media to voice what they think. And here, I must say, I've been warning about the rise of populism, particularly on the right, for 10 years. I'm very concerned about these developments, but I'm increasingly despairing about the extent to which we still continue to think that we can somehow stop these developments if only we somehow change the social media landscape, if only we tell our citizens what they're allowed to worry about and what they're not allowed to worry about. I think we would do much better at stopping some of these developments if we actually took seriously the reasons why so many citizens, not just in the United States, but also in France and also in Germany and also in every other country of the European Union, have grown to be deeply distrustful of their own political elites, of the kinds of people like the four of us who get to opine on television, of the media, of universities. If we think that all of this started 2 years ago when Elon Musk bought Twitter, I think we're living in a fantasy world.
Right.
And we're not going to find the political answers we desperately need.
All right. So there's the question of whether the American standards of free speech will be applied in Europe, the question of the outside powers of these tech titans, the question of Donald Trump's friends, Italy's Giorgia Meloni, Hungary's Viktor Orban. They have their invite for Monday, a whole host of Eurosceptic far-right figures to attend the inauguration, including the UK's Nigel Farage and France's Éric Zemmour of the far-right, not Marine Le Pen. By the way, also invited, French telecoms tycoon Xavier Niel and France's richest man, Bernard Arnault, the boss of LVMH. Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, to wear a Givenchy dress at the ceremony. Givenchy, one of the fashion houses in the stable of Arnault's Louis Vuitton. So it's a question of, everybody's got their oligarchs, Gesine? The French have theirs, the Americans have theirs, the Russians have theirs.
Well, I think that's probably part of a world where capitalism is to some extent expected. But what I think is more interesting about the inauguration is that you really have, on the one hand, the European leaders like Orban and Meloni who come in and who also already have before the inauguration, especially when it comes to Meloni, started to construct relationships with
She was last week at Mar-a-Lago in Florida.
I think that this is precisely the thing that is much more interesting than to look at who's actually attending the inauguration, because there again we are coming back to the question of leadership in Europe and who is going to be an important interlocutor.
The domestic affairs in the U.S. are really, I think, the real question here, because what we are observing now and what we are about to see in the United States is the rise of oligarchy, very Russian style. Of course, American history has already borne oligarchs, and John D. Rockefeller is one example, J.P. Morgan is another, and we have several others of this size and stature, of Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. However, to see this rise of oligarchy today in the United States coming to power fully and really basically controlling, probably most likely controlling the White House, running the White House, I think that's going to be the most important change which is going to reverberate for American leadership in the world, for this sense of security that Europe can experience, and for the sense also of freedom and the limits that Russia and China can afford themselves. Because if you have incompetence in the White House, of all places, then this has consequences everywhere. If you have that incompetence in Ecuador, in Honduras, in other respected places, it doesn't really matter. Everybody can talk about it, we can write books about it, and forget about it. But if it happens in the United States, what can happen next is, and what is happening, what is triggering now all the reflection in Brussels, is that when missiles are going to be flying toward Europe from anywhere in the world, nobody's going to be there to even notice, because nobody would be able to locate those European countries on the map from among those people who need to, in theory, respond to the missiles flying. This is the regime change in the U.S., I think, is the biggest consequence and the biggest of the oligarchy now that we are seeing kind of gone loose. And the oligarchy in a very direct way, because as a definition, somebody who has a massive fortune, controls political class, big political influence, has big political influence, and also controls the media. And by the media, of course, you raise that question, right? Of course, it's not the Financial right. Times or the New York Times that they control, but they control the media, which today attract most people.
Certainly the narrative. We'll be, of course, having full coverage of Inauguration Day right here on France 24. I want to thank you, Anastasia Shapochkina. I want to thank Gesine Weber, Craig Capitis, Yasha Monk for being with us from New York City. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.